Well, this is not a boat accident. It wasn't any propeller. It wasn't any coral reef. And it wasn't Jack the Ripper.
It was a shark.
Just when you thought it was safe to open your podcast app.
This shark, swallow you whole.
It's time for the 3 Men in a Retrospective's look at all 4 films contained in the Jaws franchise.
Oh, boys! I think he's come back for his noon feeding.
To help celebrate the original film's 50th anniversary, Garrett.
Maybe he's not indigestion, he's already eaten my plate!
Matt.
Holly sent me to find you to tell you that there's a bunch of Boy Scouts out in April Bay doing their mile swim for their merit badges.
And Adam.
Y'all know me. Know how I earn a living.
Have dared to swim the waters started by director Steven Spielberg way back in 1975.
Jesus H. Christ.
From the blockbuster original.
I got the creme de la creme.
All the way to the 1987 final film, Jaws the Revenge.
What are you, some kind of half-ass astronaut?
The guys will look at each film and determine if Jaws is indeed a one-movie franchise.
I want to be sure. You want to be sure. We all want to be sure, okay?
Smile, percolated media listeners.
Mr. Mayor, Chief, ladies and gentlemen.
The 3 Men in a Retrospective's look at Jaws begins now.
Hang on to your socks, lads.
Jaws 2. It was released June 16th, 1978. Budget on this, differing reports between $20 and $30 million. Box office, $102 million. Domestic, $208 million. Total, wow, were people hungry for sharks. And this was directed by making a return appearance to the 3 Men Retrospective podcast after Supergirl, Jeannot Swark. All right. Well, before we get to Jaws 2, guys, I have to follow up last week's podcast. Last week's podcast, I mentioned that, God, I would love to see Jaws in theaters when it's re-released. And it's just so happened that me and Jen had a day off together. This never, ever happens. We never have days off together, once or twice a year, maybe. So we were looking at things to do, and I just came across, oh, Jaws is still in theaters. Let's go see that. And she decided, okay, I haven't seen it in years. Guys, it was amazing. We went to full IMAX, and my God, they added sound effects. Jen jumped like a number of times. You know, we've done a number of theatricals this year. It's crazy for me to say this, but I have not had a better theatrical experience in the last few years than I did for a 50-year-old movie. And by the way, the thing made $10 million this weekend. I cannot believe that people were hungry to go back to see this, especially when it's on Netflix right now. Matt, were you surprised by the success of the Jaws re-release?
To a degree. Unlike some of the other re-releases they've done recently, I would say of all of them, this one has the most reputable as being kind. It's probably the most well-known movie they've done a re-release for in a long time. And it's also the dog days of summer, which is the perfect time to either go see a movie, which this had the advantage of not much competition. I think this released maybe a little bit earlier in the summer, like July 4th, maybe it wouldn't have done as well. So I think there's a couple reasons why, but you know, good for you. I didn't have the chance to go because I was on vacation, but I'm glad it did well, but I hope people don't take the wrong lessons from this and demand a remake.
Oh my God, scary to think about. Adam, were you surprised by the success, sir?
A little bit. Especially because, you know, yeah, to Matt's point, you know, it's the dog days of summer and there's stuff still kind of out there a little bit, but shit, Superman was still making money after being released on digital, and Weapons is a hit, but we talked about the release schedule already being so funky this year. I wanted this July 4th, but yeah, I don't think it would have made as much money, you know, but shoot, this was what, number 2 or 3 that weekend? Number 1 being K-pop Demon Hunters, which was on Netflix already. Yeah. And only got 2 days, you know, in movie theaters, and it made like $21 million that weekend. So the box office is a weird one this year. This shit is yeah. I don't know. Make a movie about it, because it makes no sense anymore. But I was happy for it. You know, it's 50th anniversary. I think this is when stuff needs to get re-released. I was hoping to go see it. We didn't get a chance. We did go see Little Shop of Horrors in theaters because they re-released that. And that was an absolute blast. And in fact, I had seen the original ending, which I had never seen before. I only saw the happy ending, so I was glad to see the original. But I like events when they do it and they make sense. And Jaws 50 in theaters, mwah. I mean, chef's kiss. You couldn't have done it any better.
All right. Well, that was last week. We said all we needed to say about the first Jaws, 2+ hour podcast. Now it's time to talk about its sequels, starting with Jaws 2. Now, this movie, oh boy, what another troubled production. I can do that here in a bit, but I want to mention that I first saw this movie when I used to go to my grandparents' houses. I had two sets of grandparents, one in Oregon, one set of grandparents in Chicago. And my parents would take me when I was a kid to these places, and then to occupy me while they went out with them and did stuff or played cards or whatever, they would take me to a video store. We'd rent movies. This movie was one that we rented, and they put me in front of the TV, said, okay, you're occupied now. And I liked this a lot as a kid. I'll talk about what I feel about it as an adult. But Matt, when did you first see Jaws 2?
Oh boy, that's the question of the day. I couldn't tell you. I watched the sequels not until my teenage years. I did watch them pretty concurrently. The only thing I vividly remember about Jaws 2 before this rewatch were the posters and some of the marketing materials. I had forgotten most of the context of the movie itself. So in a lot of ways, these movies, more so 2 and 3, I've seen 4 several times. But it's been a long time since I watched this. I mean, I couldn't even tell you how they killed the shark at the end of this. That's how little, wow. Oh, sorry, spoilers. Unless this is one of those sequels where the shark wins.
And Adam, am I correct in assuming this is a first-time viewing for you, correct?
The rest of these are going to be first-time viewings, wow, for me, yes. I know the tagline, you know, to this one. That's as far as I know. But look, I'm not a huge Spielberg guy for some of his movies, so I just never cared. I just never cared to go and see this.
Okay, well, you did see it, and I cannot wait to hear your thoughts on it. Before we get to the actual plot itself, let's talk about the plot of the behind the scenes. Because by the end of 1975, these producers knew they had a hit. Hell, Fonzie ended up jumping a shark in between, which became a whole thing. And shark mania was rampant. And we also had the knockoffs, Matt. We had Piranha. We had Orca. A lot of stuff was launched because of Jaws, wasn't it?
Yes, and you saw both extremes. You saw Orca, which was the prestige, quote-unquote, version, because it was made in Italy. You had Richard Harris and Charlotte Rampling, very reputable actors. But then De Laurentiis got a hold of that.
Yep.
The movie kind of, it's a notorious bad movie. I mean, they even take their pot shot at Jaws by the fact that the killer whale kills a great white at the beginning of the movie, if you've never seen it. And then on the inverse, you have Piranha, which is Roger Corman. So you had Roger Corman and De Laurentiis both trying to capitalize on the success of Jaws. But Piranha, I will say, is actually, I can't call it underrated because it's got a cult following, as most Joe Dante films do. But it's a lot of fun. And I watched it pretty recently because they put out a very nice Blu-ray of it with Shout Factory. I think around the time they did the 3D one that came out like 10 years ago, which I thought that movie was awful, but not, you shouldn't set out to make a bad movie, which I talked about in previous shows, but Orca is kind of painful to watch. The original Joe Dante Piranha is actually fun, although there are parts where you can literally see guys shaking piranhas on sticks, because let's not forget it's a Roger Corman production. And we have to thank Piranha 2 for getting James Cameron,
yep,
his career. So Jaws, yes, in a lot of in an indirect way, started the careers of both Joe Dante and James Cameron, two directors I like a lot.
And I think Jaws 2 gets back at Orca in this movie, which we'll talk about.
Oh, it does. Yeah. And this came out the same year as Piranha, which, yep, is ironic.
Yeah, 1978.
You will believe a man can fly to, you won't believe how cheap this Piranha movie is.
1978. We talked about Superman from this year. And by the time that this movie was out, the first Jaws was already overtaken as the most successful movie of all time, which we discussed a couple years ago. The first Star Wars movie was out. But they wanted to bring the band back together. But in order to do that, they brought in this director by the name of John D. Hancock. Now, this guy had done a movie called Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which I think is an underrated 70s film. Haven't seen too much of his other stuff, but he was brought on along with his wife. And Matt, have you heard the concept of what he came up with?
No, the only stuff I know about this movie is that, like, Roy Scheider made it at gunpoint. That's really the only, yeah, so much so that he took Blue Thunder, so there was no way they could ask him to be in Jaws 3.
Yes. All right, well, John D. Hancock came up with this idea. It's an interesting idea. He wanted to bring the Mafia subplot from last week that we talked about, from the book. And he wanted to make Amity kind of a desolate town, kind of a ghost town. It was known as Shark Island, and kind of explore that concept and what goes on there. And when producers brought him on, along with his wife, they realized that the concept he was going for was a little darker of a concept, so they fired him and his wife. They also said that he had a real issue with the mechanical sharks, and he said, well, they're not working. And the producers were like, look, you're already on this film. You've already cost us tens of millions of dollars. We're going to kick you off. So Carl Gottlieb was once again called, along with Howard Sackler. They came in, they wrote a script. And Carl Gottlieb, I guess, good friends with Spielberg, good friends with George Lucas. And he kind of took the concept of American Graffiti and brought it to Jaws, which instead of driving cars, they're driving boats around. So that was a concept that he brought to this. And they decided to instead go with the continuation of the Brodies. Speaking of the Brodies, Matt, you already mentioned it. Let's talk about Roy Scheider. Now, Roy Scheider was contractually obligated to Universal, and in negotiations for The Deer Hunter, walked off. I guess he felt like he wasn't paid enough money. He had the De Niro role, which, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't that win De Niro an Oscar?
No, Walken was the one who won an Oscar.
Oh, Walken won for it. Okay.
I'm sure De Niro was probably nominated, but that's also weird because Scheider at that point would have been considerably older than De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
So, because those guys are supposed to be like fresh out of college or like college age and they get drafted. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen it. But, I mean, bad decision in hindsight because Deer Hunter is a really good movie, although I will only watch it once and I will never go back to it. But Scheider's always had a weird career because he was always known as the Jaws guy, and he never kind of shook that. Even though he did All That Jazz, which is one of my favorite movies, I think that's probably his best performance. But that wasn't until after Jaws 2.
So he walks off that movie. He had a 3-film contract, and they said, we'll let you get out of this contract if you do Jaws 2. Apparently, there's legends around that maybe he tried getting out of it any way he could. Apparently, him and Janos Swart got into arguments on the set. Physical arguments, actually. They got into fist fights a couple of times. The studio had to make amends by having them write letters to each other. And eventually, by mid-production, they were okay and they finished it. But I don't know, man. You're Roy Scheider. You go from Steven Spielberg to this TV director. And you're not happy because you're kind of a lone wolf on this.
Kind of. I mean, you brought a couple other actors back. I wonder if they got Dreyfus somehow, if he would have been a little bit more even keeled, and he would not have had to been like the main lead of the movie. They could have kind of split roles, or you bring Dreyfus in and kill Brody off somehow. There's a lot of different configurations you could have done, but you can tell watching this movie that he does not want to be there. This is very much one of the worst examples of contractual obligations rearing their ugly head, to the point where you can tell that he would rather be anywhere else than making this movie. Speaking of sequels, this is kind of a Gene Hackman in Superman 4, where it's, I am only here because they are paying me to be here.
Adam, as somebody who had not seen this film, could you feel that? Could you feel that Scheider did not want to be here?
Oh my God, I felt like I was watching Natalie Portman on some of the prequel movies. It was just, like, it is so obvious. And I tried to really hold back from looking into anything about this film. Usually I'll go through IMDb beforehand and I wanted nothing spoiled. I wanted this as virginal as possible, other than the tagline, which I knew. And it's so obvious. But there's parts where I think the movie shifts into some really good portions that I'm like, damn, why isn't this the movie? But it's clear he wants to be a lot of places, but it is not in this movie.
My favorite quote, though, from anybody is Spielberg being quoted as saying, making a sequel to anything is a cheap carny trick.
I was getting to that. So they did ask Spielberg to come back, and at first that was his excuse. Because you got to put yourself in the mentality of the late 70s. Sequels were not a big thing back then.
Well,
no, but what an arrogant asshole of a guy that's made like 3 films to be like, sequels are just, I mean, what an erudite piece of, like, he's an asshole.
Well, that was what.
Yeah, and let's not forget, this is the same man who begged Michael Crichton to write another Jurassic Park book.
Yeah, 20 years later.
Well, yeah, even 10 years later.
When he needed a sequel to save his career.
Yeah, he needed Temple of Doom. Well, I know that's a prequel, but, all right. So the thing about sequels, you gotta remember, numerical sequels were not a thing. The Godfather Part 2 is really the one that, I mean, part of it's because it was so critically lauded and won all the Oscars and stuff, but sequels at the time, when you did them back in the day, it's not that sequels weren't being made, it's that they weren't numbered. Because, like, look at all the Universal Monster movies. tons of sequels, but they always had different titles like Son of Dracula or Bride of Frankenstein. That's how you kind of masked the fact that you were making so many.
And A Town of the Two Jakes, yeah.
Or like you had like Tarzan, the Tarzan movies. Tarzan Finds a Mate or Tarzan and Jane go to space. Like that's how you got around the fact you were making sequels. So this was kind of a, looking at it now, of course they would make a sequel, but this was a, I hate to use this pun again, it was a watershed moment because you were following up one of the most commercially successful films of all time during a period where this was not the norm.
That was his quote at the time, and then later on, he would say, just the experience of doing the first one kind of put me off to doing the sequel. So they brought this Jeannot Swark, who, again, like I mentioned, he had a couple TV credits. I guess they did the old Marvel thing of, well, we're just going to hire this guy for cheap and see if he comes through.
Well, they had the last 30 years, that's all he has is a few TV credits.
Well, you also look, I mean, they did that to offset the fact that this is the most expensive film that Universal had ever produced. $30 million, that's a shitload of money for the time.
Absolutely. In the mid-70s. Whew.
So they, again, had trouble with the shark, but Schwark made the decision, and I think it was a wise decision. He's like, look, you're not going to top the shark coming up to Scheider moment from the last film, so we're just going to keep showing the shark. And like I said, him and Scheider got into arguments, but Scheider's not the only one brought back. They brought back Lorraine Gary, who she wasn't doing much, and they brought back Murray Hamilton, and they brought back John Williams, which was the amazing thing.
Did they?
They did. Yeah. Well, here's what I'll say about Williams. They once again ran into issues where they could not finish this goddamn movie on time. So Williams, a lot of his score is him not even seeing the film. And if you know Williams' scores, you know his scores go hand in hand with the scenes themselves. That wasn't the case with a lot of this score, and I think it does show. So the movie's out. I'm telling you, though, they spent $30 million on this thing. It made over $200 million worldwide, $102 domestic, which shocked me. That's a lot of money, boys, for 1978. And it would not be surpassed until Rocky II the very next year.
Well, you also, one of the things that also really benefited this film was the amount of merchandising they put into it.
Yes.
I mean, considerably more than the first one. You had trading cards, you had Coca-Cola cups, you had what I will consider one of the greatest taglines of all time for a movie, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water.
Yep.
I think that's a great title. The problem is they use, I guess the shark that's on the posters looks kind of derpish because it doesn't look like it's not the same shark, but it makes the poster kind of look like a cheap knockoff, not an actual sequel to the movie because they changed the shark design a bit.
All right. Well, that's a lot of the production. Ended up being a success. Boys, let's talk about whether it was a narrative success. So we open up with John Williams coming back, but man, this score has a different feel in the beginning here. I like that he went different and not with the same notes that we saw had last week, but this beginning was kind of jarring. I will say, though, having John Williams conduct a slasher score is kind of cool. I think the stuff he does later is pretty good, but this opening theme is a little weird, isn't it?
You use weird, I use bad. I did not think, and I had to go look, I didn't think this was John Williams. This reminds me of the first time that I was in theaters watching Rogue One, and it was like, okay, what's this composing going to be? Ooh, it's just going to be a bad, different kind of take. If you did not know that John Williams was in this, if you did not see his name in the credits, I don't think anybody would say this is a John Williams score. This is someone who didn't see the movie, maybe didn't even want to do it, but was like, damn, they're offering me more money than they did last time. And I don't know. This score is just really not good. But I will say, to your point, it does sound like a slasher score. It sounds like a slasher movie. And I'll go ahead and put it out right now. This movie is a 70s slasher movie in almost every facet.
Yep, Halloween will come around later on that year. Well, you can't not see the fact that Williams is scoring this because his name is up there prominently right after the cast. But it's different for sure. Matt, as somebody who does not have much opinion on scores, did you feel this difference?
I get the sense that John Williams was there in body only. I don't feel like he was really into it. But also his compositions, it's not that he wasn't established because he had done Jaws and Star Wars and some other things. But his like process of watching the movie and then taking like a number two pencil and jotting down like where to put music. A lot of his best stuff is with Spielberg. And you can tell that not having that perspective is a hindrance because there are several scenes where the score is out of place or it's overly bombastic or it's not enough. Like it's all over the place in this.
We're seeing an underwater expedition as they go investigate the orca. I like this as it has some continuity and it kind of puts a bookmark on the last film. So the divers go in, they take some pictures, they're farting around a little bit until we hear the John Williams theme, and here comes another shark to interrupt the proceedings. And I wonder if this flashing camera will come into play later on.
Because that's how cameras work. And because suddenly the orca, while it was underground, I guess some fucking mermaids decided to come and put the name orca on the side of the boat. Because it's not there in Jaws.
All right, so my problem extends to, right off the bat, this movie fails at creating any kind of suspense. Because the shark just busts in like the Kool-Aid man.
Yeah.
And it's so like, it's all jerky, like there's no buildup to it. And it ends so abruptly. I felt nothing watching this. If you were trying to build up to the shark, and I get, like, there's, you don't have that mystique of building up to the shark, so we're going to show it right away. But by doing the inverse and doing it so abruptly, it doesn't work as a, like, cold opening. Because if you were going to do that, then let me see, like, someone's arm get ripped off. But you don't get that. It just cuts.
It's amazing how that first movie was so suspenseful and drawn in. Like, you're at the edge of your seat, you know, 90 seconds into the movie. And here, I'm already getting off my couch and walking into the kitchen to open my fridge randomly. Like, it's amazing how I am sucked out of the movie immediately.
Wow. All right, so we move on to Brody, a.k.a. Roy Scheider, being, as I said earlier, pretty pissed off. Here's the problem with Brody in this film. And I think this will kind of come into my summarization of the entire film when we get to our reviews. The things that worked most about Jaws, yes, the shark scenes were amazingly shot, but it was the way he played off the other two. Without Dreyfuss, without Shaw, without Spielberg here guiding him, he can't carry this film. It's not that he can't carry it, I just don't think they give him anything really big to carry with this.
Well, it's weird, because a lot of the stuff I think would work on the page. Because the family dynamic in this and focusing on the kids, it's very Spielbergian in that aspect. But it's only on the surface level, no pun intended. Because the movie doesn't take its time to really explore like the family. I mean, we know that Mike is rebellious and Brody's obviously, there's some tension there. But it's not all that explored. And you would think, okay, if you're going to do that, then we're going to see like the family kind of disintegrate. And kind of do the, you know, build up to like E.T. where the dad's out of the picture. But we don't get any of that. And like I said, the biggest problem is Scheider just looks so... And you can't just read it based on, oh, the character's kind of put upon. But you can't use that as an excuse for his performance, because he doesn't get upset until they do the thing of like nobody believes him about the shark. Like even early on when he's supposed to be happy, he just looks visibly annoyed.
Yeah, I think Schneider thought that they'd maybe change the name from Chief Brody to Chief Board, because that's how he looks throughout so much of this. I like the possibility of a dramatic turn on so much of this. And when the drama hits, I'm like, ooh, this is pretty good. Two things. Was there an older teenage son last week?
Well, he was around 12.
Yeah, this is canonically 4 years after the first.
Okay, for some reason, I only remember one kid. That was just me. I'm like, where the hell is this kid away at like boarding school? Okay, so that's my fault. But I don't know. I do almost feel like the way that this family dynamic is going is, yeah, it is Spielberg in tone, but I think you hit it. What worked last week, yes, it's a horror film. Yes, it's a slasher film, but it's an amazing dramatic piece anytime you get some of the dialogue together, whether it's Dreyfuss, Schneider, all of it works. He has no one to play against here that is any good whatsoever. The people that he does have to bounce dialogue back and forth, there's no chemistry. None. School's out.
They do have Murray Hamilton here, but the thing about Murray Hamilton that happened was he came to Schwark early on in the production and said, look, my wife's having a biopsy done. She might have cancer. I don't know if I want to be here. And Schwark said, okay, we'll get all your scenes done in 5 days. And I think that's another actor that when you look at him, you can tell that he kind of doesn't want to be there either.
And you could have done something, because I think Lorraine Gary is maybe trying the most, but because this is the 70s and because this is that kind of production, you're going to pigeonhole her into a worthless female role. But I don't know, let her maybe take over the town, let her be elected mayor. You could have done something with it, but giving her this bullshit timeshare plot. I don't know. I feel like she is at least trying here.
Well, they gave her the job of putting this party in the beginning together. This was all her.
Into this party.
Yeah.
You read the banner.
Yeah, I did. And, of course, they were also going to shoehorn this plot with this Len Peterson that we'll talk about here in a bit, who was going to have an affair with her. And, you know, they're going to do all that bullshit again, which Carl Gottlieb immediately ixnayed. I think they did more with her than most 70s female characters.
Yes, but the bar is also so low that there's nowhere. The fact that she has dialogue is an upgrade over most of these type of things. Because even, like, use The Godfather as an example. If you think about Godfather Part 2, even Talia Shire doesn't get as much as she does in the first one. Diane Keaton does. She gets great stuff. But you can tell also Murray Hamilton's very kind of comatose, and he's definitely really not into it. Because you would think this movie would explore, if you're not going to have the town be, like, desolate, the fact that he's so, like, brushing it off when the possibility is staring him in the face. He could do something with that where he's just in straight up denial, but the movie has no interest in exploring anything beneath the surface. And also, first of all, what this hotel opening, why are you doing this in front of the goddamn pool? Like the layout of this makes no sense, because all it takes is for one person to fall in.
I know.
I thought that was kind of tongue-in-cheek of like, oh, we're showing that we've moved past this by showing it's okay to be near the water.
Yeah.
But one of the other problems with this movie, there's no levity. You know, the first one, you have some, there's great banter back and forth, and, you know, Hooper's not comic relief, but him and Quint get some good stuff back and forth. Here, it's very, very drab.
Yeah, there's no real, even last week's dinner scene was captivating, as Hooper's like, let that breathe a little bit, and Brody just fills it up without even letting it breathe. Like, all that stuff is what makes that movie as good as it is, and you're right, there's none of that here. We're all surface level. So Brody's trying to drive through traffic, and Adam, how many times have we gone through Northern California shooing off trucks as they pull in front of us? Hell, I still do it in Reno to this day. We see Brody walk in, and Ellen tells him to act like he's been here the entire time, a.k.a. act bored, which Adam has pointed out.
Oh, yeah, that's very self-reflective.
Yeah. I like this reintroduction to these characters, though. I will say, you guys are knocking this. I have a lot of residual love for these characters, and I like seeing them back together. I like seeing the band back together, as they say. I like seeing Brody and Ellen together.
Yeah, no, I like those two together. Everything about this just seems... It's amazing that this thing cost like three times as much as the first one. I think this movie looks cheap.
Wow.
I think it's shot cheap. It feels like an early 70s cheap ass slasher film. And it looks that way, and it feels that way all the way down to the extras that are postulated throughout. The first one, I know that movie is set when it is. It never, ever makes me feel like it is stamped in time. This movie feels like it's Friday the 13th Part 3 in the way that it's just badly dressed and placed in a spot. I don't know. I am ripped out kind of any time anybody around this movie is talking.
Wow, see, I don't feel that. We're going to get a helicopter scene later. We're going to get all these boats going back and forth, this mechanical shark. I think this movie doesn't look as cheap as you're saying.
Call me Steeler's wheel, because I'm stuck in the middle of both of you. My problem with the... with the filmmaking is something feels off about, I don't know what they shot this on, if it's 35 millimeter or what, but something's off with the grain on a lot of the shots. Like, everything has this kind of murky look to it when it's not shot on the water. And I think that's a problem, because some of these scenes also don't look like they're lit especially well. It's a lot of dark photography, which I think makes it look or seem like it's a lot cheaper than it actually is. Because there's parts where you can tell where they put the money into it, but... I mean, there's one scene that I totally forgot about and kind of made rewatching this movie somewhat worth my time. But for large portions of it, I feel like, I mean, this looks like it was shot at your local Holiday Inn.
It's so weird that you say that, because they brought back the same cinematographer from last week.
Yeah, that's what makes it weird. Yeah. So much of the players are back, but the game is not the same. Like, this movie's the perfect example of knowing the notes but not the music. Because structurally, it's trying to be the first one. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is freaking Die Hard 2 before that got made.
We're getting this introduction to Tina, who gets a wolf whistle from fucking Brody, which, oh my god. So
you're saying if he was replaced by Woody Allen, that would have made sense.
Now, this chick is actually married to Terminator composer Brad Fidel, which... was an interesting fact I found.
Yeah, she only made a couple more movies. She made Cutter's Way with Jeff Bridges, which is really good, but that's basically it.
Mm-hmm. And this is when we're getting a little bit of an overview of Mike and his friends. And can I say, well, I like Sean, this guy they got to play Mike is just a terrible actor. Oh my God, this guy who plays Brody's kid. Wow, does he not know how to deliver lines.
Well, that's how I feel about this entire youth movement cast. Like, this is the... they sacrificed quality for quantity, because for as many characters as they are, we don't know anything about them, and they're one note, to the point that comparing this to the Friday the 13th movies, the good ones, those characters are pretty distinctive, all things considered, even if they're kind of gimmicky. Like, you know, I think of Crispin Glover, I think of the counselors in part two, you can tell them apart. I know next to nothing about any of these kids, outside of the fact one of them's played by Keith Gordon, and he's the nerd, because of course he is. But outside of that, I can't tell them apart. I don't care about them. And for a movie, like, this could have been, not just because of the Spielberg attachment, but think of stuff like the Goonies, where as much as I don't like the movie, I think those kids have a good rapport amongst each other. And the way they talk over each other, the way they, like, curse. In the inverse of this, it's very sanitized for being a prototypical slasher movie. It makes the fact that the second half of this movie is following them all the more insufferable, because I hate them all.
And we're also getting Len Peterson introduced here too. But yeah, I'm with you, Matt. This party is a nice little scene. It gets us reacquainted as well as introduces us to these characters. But I'm also going to say there are just way too many characters in this movie. These could have been easily consolidated.
Could have been easily eaten, and I would have been into it a lot more. I mean, Bruce too has got to eat. Yeah, feed the shark. I can't stand these kids. I can't distinguish them apart. I can't tell them apart. Like, okay, I know one of these is Brody's kid. Guess what? Half an hour from now, I can't fucking tell which one is which. All the males look the same, and you got two females, one with long blonde hair and one with shoulder-length blonde hair, who screams more than any woman I have seen since freaking Temple of Doom. Like, Spielberg must have watched this and went, oh, I got a fucking idea. I cannot stand these teenagers, and I don't care, and I am pissed they survived at the end.
They only kill off, what, two of them?
Two of them, yeah, that's just it. Yeah. If you have this many... you kill them. Friday the 13th ended up doing that a couple years later. And I think what they were scared of was the MPAA. I think they wanted to bring those kids into the theaters. They knew they had a hit on their hands. So they brought all these people in, and they didn't want to put an R rating on this. You got it.
I heard they were given a body count specifically they had to stay under. Yep. And it's amazing because, yeah, this movie's PG. You know, think about that. But I feel it's not anywhere near as scary or voracious as the first, even though I think it's got a few more kills.
Yeah, well, there's also, like, this movie feels very, I keep using these goddamn puns, but they're more clever than this movie. It's so toothless. Like, for a movie about a great white shark, like there's very little blood. There's not even, like, blood spurts in the water when people get eaten. Yeah, God, just, it feels like a freaking, I thought Spielberg directed that, later Spielberg directed this, you know, the guy who took the guns out of E.T., because it feels so, like, forget PG, if you remove, like, couple uses of the word damn and kids cursing, which is not even that. I mean, the kids in the Goonies say more ridiculous stuff, and that's PG-13.
I don't know, man. The mayor's kid calls one chick, she has tits like a sparrow.
That's just more, good 70s screenwriting.
Well, no, that was him actually ad-libbing, and he actually ended up apologizing to that girl later on. But yeah, I think there's a little bit of teeth here. I think I'm going to be more easy on this movie than you guys. It's not that I like these characters, but I just feel like they should have just killed some more than they did. And by the way,
they should have killed one of the Brody kids.
That would have added some stakes. Or kill the mayor's kid. You know, he was on that beach too, as we heard last week.
Or the mayor.
Yeah, or the mayor, yeah. And Adam, keep your eye on this Keith Gordon. We'll be talking about him again next year when we get to Christine.
Oh, dear.
Well, that's just the problem. Like, killing off his kid would have given him, like, the impetus to send Brody, like, to go actually kill the shark. This one could have done this time it's personal, but actually made it make sense.
Oh, God. Yeah. As opposed to a couple weeks.
Uh-oh.
I do like the shot of the shark by the boats at night. This was a shot that was composed for last week's film, but as we discussed, they had enough problems with that one, so Gottlieb wanted it done for this one. So we know that the presence is out there. And by the way, my TV at that time, my copy of this video cassette wasn't the best, so it was a really hard shot to see when my parents recorded it off TV for me. We're hearing that the punch is terrible, and Brody and Ellen just want to leave to fool around, which was a nice little callback to last week. We cut to the next day, as Hendrix is back. That was a Janos Schwartz thing. He saw the script and he was like, well, hey, we don't have Brody's little friend Hendrix. We got to bring him back. And he offers to go out.
This guy is one holy away from being Burt Ward's Robin. with the amount of, like, in a movie this dour, he is way too golly gee whiz. And he feels like he should be, like, 16.
Yeah.
Not a guy pushing 30.
Yeah. Barney Fife him out. Goalie, Sarge.
Otis, were you followed?
He offers to go out and investigate what happened the previous day so the chief doesn't have to. Cut to Mike getting ready to go out in the water as Tina shows up, as does this cousin who we hear, again, has tits like a sparrow. And as Adam mentioned, this chick will also learn has one of the loudest, most annoying screams in film history. We see the boats out in the water and water balloons getting thrown as we get some montage music from Williams here. We see that...
This movie thinks water sailing is the most amazing thing.
Well, if you live on an island, it would be.
No, these are the kind of kids who would be staying home and just drinking on the beach. Like, they wouldn't actually be getting on boats as much as they do.
We see that Brody is again dealing with small island problems as Hendrix shows up with the camera from the beginning of the film. We cut to a parachute diver. I'm not sure if I've seen these parachute dives into water, but it's here that we establish that, yes, there is still a shark in the water. It also almost gets this guy. Were we ever in suspense? Like, did we think that this guy was going to get it when the shark is coming up?
I wanted him to. Like, I was hoping to see a cool kill because the suspense is missing, so I need something to get my adrenaline going. But maybe it's just because of the way that it's shot. I don't want to knock this guy too much. God knows we did that earlier with when we discussed Supergirl. But the way that Spielberg delivered a sense of dread and foreboding was masterful. There is none of that in this film. So if you're not going to give me suspense, give me some cool-ass kills. And, I mean, we get some. I don't want to say it's missing, but... there sure as hell is no anticipation for me. Just get there.
Well, it's just so funny to me that this movie is the archetype for so many slasher movies without the smug satisfaction of watching, like, gory kills. So it just feels like a waste of time. It's all foreplay and no enjoyment.
Well, I think it's here to set up what we're going to get next, as we establish that we get the big set piece of the movie, that of this shark pursuing and killing the skier and this boat. Now, when I was a kid... when I was a kid, this fucking scene terrified me. But I watch it now. I do like the shark just kind of gliding through the water. They got this sled with this fin on it, and they pull it. That's how they got that effect. It was cool seeing it just move at a breakneck speed. And they also got the footage from last week. They got the footage that the couple who took the shark footage from last week, they interjected some of the real shark footage here. I like it catching up to the skier and how it intercuts between the real shark and the fake one. But we move on to the boat. And this woman pours gas on herself and fires a flare gun to make the whole boat explode. My God, is this a comedy of errors?
My favorite scene.
Comedy is right, because I'm laughing. I'm not exhilarated whatsoever. Well, there are some cool shots of that fin coming up out of the water. I will admit that. I think some of that's pretty damn cool. The downside of me seeing this now for the first time as a mid-40s man is I've seen that spoofed in so many movies. I mean, it's Freddy Krueger, you know, with the glove before he comes up on the beach. So I've seen it. But there's some really cool shots there. A lot of the shots where you're focusing on a boat, and if you don't pay attention to the background and notice that there's a fin in the background shots, like, I think some of those ideas are really, really cool. A shark catching up to a water skier has got to be one of the most ludicrous fucking things. As someone who out here on the Delta in the East Bay area of California grew up water skiing and kneeboarding, I can't help but shake my head. I can't. And then I understand if she was maybe trying to pour gas on the shark and it slipped, but it seems like she purposely doused herself just to shoot herself in the foot. It's fucking ridiculous. And that explosion makes the one from last week just look even more goofy by design.
It's the funniest unintentional hilarity of, you think she's pouring the gasoline on herself to, like, commit suicide rather than be eaten by the shark, but the fact that they cut to a wide shot and you watch the boat explode makes this look like something you would have seen in The Naked Gun. It's so ridiculous, and I mean, it woke me up because I find most of this movie to be pretty laborious, but I'm laughing at this for reasons that I don't think were intended.
What is a gas can doing on that boat?
Oh, you always bring a gas can on a boat.
Do you?
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh,
okay. Wow. See, I've been on a lot of boats. I don't remember, but I haven't been on one in a while. But this scene is also here, guys, to explain, we got Scarface Shark. We're going to give this shark a huge scar just to kind of distinguish it and make it more menacing.
That's in my notes. Like, I can't believe you disfigured a shark just because. Though Spielberg had to love it.
I'm not sure about that. We cut to Hendrix and Brody looking for the bodies of the two women who were killed. And then we see Brody talk to Tina and her boyfriend. And they're talking to Brody about the accident and the old woman who witnessed the explosion. And then we see Brody look at the water like, oh shit, I think we have another shark problem. We slowly fade to Hendrix and this old man dragging the water. And then we get Chekhov's power line established here.
oh my,
as soon as this, of like three times.
Yeah, as soon as this pulled up, I'm like, oh, that's right. And the memory started coming back to me like a bad Vietnam flashback. Because this is so telegraphed that Earl Hebner could see it coming.
Oh my God.
And know the spots. Like, it's so, that's the only reason this is here. And the fact they make such a definitive call and reference of, hey, be careful, that's the city's power line.
Just laugh, because every time that they reference this thing, I know how it's going to come into play.
We see breakfast at the Brody house, complete with Cheerios, right on display. And this doesn't feel as natural as the last film, I don't think.
No, I have expected some product placement.
Well, there was. That's what I mentioned.
But I mean like a Jaws cereal or like Shark Bites or something.
Mike says that he's going sailing again, and Brody asks about the job he was offered. But Ellen is against him having a job. Brody asks why everyone here is a boat freak, and Ellen says, it's an island. Brody tells Mike to be careful out there, as there's been some trouble, and Mike promises to be careful. We then cut to Tina running from her boyfriend Eddie with his hat in her hand as they come across the fakest looking killer whale I've ever seen.
This looks like a prop you could buy at Party City.
Now, this gal who is here to investigate this whale, this oceanographer, Jesus Christ, Matt, this should have been Hooper, right?
Or at the very least, it could have been somebody who knows how to read lines.
Yeah, she's pretty bad.
It looks like she's reading cue cards off screen, because she's always looking down, or she never makes eye contact with Brody. I keep thinking that the lines are in the fucking whale carcass, and that's why she keeps looking at it.
See, I think they should have started the movie with this. All it does is repeat what happens when they find the body washed up from the first film. It's the exact same, you know, two kids running on the beach and they stumble across a body. This time it just happens to be an orca. Get it, everybody? Because orca. Put a sign on it that wasn't there before. But if you would have started this with just this killer whale washed up that had been killed, you could have, I think, done a little bit different into something of this movie. But as it stands, I mean, okay. I mean, there's no suspense as to what happened and who did it. And yeah, the line readings, the actor, everything about this is so much lesser. Everybody's performance is bad. And then when Brody shows up, Schneider's just, I mean, he's there because he has to be, and it shows.
Yeah, one thing this scene proves to me is the first Jaws, it doesn't work as well without the power of the three that they had. Here, we're trying to make up for it with a shit ton of characters that just mean nothing, including this character. Why wasn't this character brought back? You know,
well to use... This is watching Bill Murray in Ghostbusters 2.
And nobody should ever watch Ghostbusters 2.
But that's what this movie reminds me of, where it's like it's doing the same beats, but at least Ghostbusters 2, you can say the first part of that movie, like before they become Ghostbusters, is interesting. This one just feels like it's very routine, where it's like, oh, this is almost the exact same point where they do an autopsy of the tiger shark, and this is also their dig at the movie Orca.
Definitely.
Which, for the record, Universal actually tried to block Piranha's release because it came out the same year as this, but Spielberg himself liked the movie so much that he said, you guys need to back off. I wish he did that about the release of Jaws 3, but...
Oh, we'll get there. Brody is convinced that this was a great white shark, and she said that they're attracted to sound. So keep this in mind, kids, for the end of the film. I mean, they were establishing a lot about what's going to happen at the end of this thing.
Well, you say setup, I say spelling it out, where it's on those cue cards that they're going to bring back and show to the audience by the end of the film.
Well, I mean, it's so spelled out, they might as well have had freaking the count from Sesame Street show up to tell the audience what's about to happen.
So Brody tells Mike to not take the boat out, as now he's been grounded. And this is when Brody brings up the idea that if a shark was destroyed and another one come out, shall we say, will it take it personal and go out for revenge? Keep this in mind, kids.
Knowing one of the subtitles, I cannot believe that when I heard that line, I wanted to rage quit this retrospective. I swear to God.
And she's just like, nope, sharks don't take things personal. Keep that in mind. Brody continues looking out in the ocean, and we cut to him cornering Larry, who somehow got reelected after last week's film. Brody tells Larry that they may have another shark problem, given the two missing people and the whale that's washed ashore. And Larry just calls it a boating accident and wonders if all the ones who are missing are shark attacks. So this character has literally no arc.
Yeah, it's the sequel thing of we have to take our characters back to square one where there's no growth. And this is also a movie that throws common sense out the window. Even amidst all this, it is very plausible evidence. Like, it's not circumstantial. Like, he's very sound in his logic. And what reason does he have to not believe him?
Well,
because the town has recovered from a shark attack, apparently. It would make more sense if the town was so desolate and he was desperate for business that he's blinding himself to it out of sheer ignorance, but that's not here.
The weird thing is, in the editing room, they cut out a couple scenes where he is sympathetic to Brody. When he gets fired later on...
Yeah, he's the only one who doesn't vote against it. Yeah,
he's the only one who doesn't vote against it. But we get none of that here. He's just kind of going along with this fucking condo developer. Somehow, some way, he's like the new villain of the film. And the mayor's just here as a tag-along. I don't like this dynamic.
No, I don't either. And I wish there was something else. Like, maybe even if Amity was trying to capture, just fame by being the island that survived the shark. And then when it came back, it turned it all into an oh shit moment. I mean, there's no press whatsoever. There's no, even there's no townspeople. We talked last week that even the non-actors that they populated that film with made it feel so real. And I don't feel like there's any of them in this film.
Well, that's because they didn't want to be in this film. When they came back, there were shirts that said Universal Go Home. They did not want this shit again.
And this doesn't, to me, this, I had to look, because to me, there's no way they filmed this in the same spot. None of this film feels like it was filmed same location that we got in Jaws.
They did film a little bit there, but they also went to Florida, which you can definitely tell the differences. So Larry says that they called the marine biologist from before and nothing she saw was proof of anything. Brody tells the mayor to remember this conversation and then leaves. We then see him driving and seeing something out in the ocean. He stops and goes out into the water, and I had no idea that Jaws would resort to jump scares like the perfect ones we had last week, but this is exactly what we were trying to mimic. Man, this body comes out. This is supposed to mimic the fisherman from last week, right?
Yeah, and it's also, you skipped over the last scene. He does the Harrison Ford finger point.
Yeah.
Which I very much appreciate.
I felt like they were trying, and trying too hard.
We cut to Brody making cyanide bullets laced with candle wax.
Which never come back into play.
Well, they do at the beach scene, but...
Oh, that's right, yeah.
If this was to go into a full-on descent into madness, like if he turns into Quint, you have a story to go there with. Like, I love the possibility that he's got this cyanide and he's going to make cyanide bullets, which doesn't really make sense. But I don't care because I fucking love that he's going to go into this depravity and it doesn't go anywhere.
Well, here's the thing. We're seeing him do this and they could have gone that route, but we know there's a shark out there. So everything he's doing, it's not that it makes sense, but we know that he's right. That's the issue. Brody's covering this as Hendrix shows up, and Brody is even walking around with a shirt open here. Hendrix gives Brody a look of, what the hell are you doing? And then Brody tells Hendrix to get the photos developed. When Brody gets home, he hears that Hooper is out on the Aurora and not available, because of course he is. Boy, could we have used some Dreyfus here.
Exact same thing that he said when Universal called.
Yeah. Boy, could we have used some Dreyfus here. And him and Spielberg were off, obviously, doing Close Encounters. But when me and Jen went and saw the first Jaws last week, every single time Dreyfus is on screen, like, she was laughing. We get none of that levity here.
I do think, though, I think if Dreyfus is here, I don't think this film gets completed. Because I think him and Schneider together would have beat the shit out of this director so bad. Because I do think they would have teamed up together and just, I think this would have been an unacceptable production.
Brody tells Ellen that he pulled a body out of the ocean and he thinks it might have been one of the accident victims from earlier, but this is just routine. Brody then tells Mike that there's a job that requires Mike to be grounded all summer. We cut to another montage, this time of people going to the beach as well as Brody in the shark tower. And everyone is just dumbfounded as to why he's up there. And this fucking little kid's like, I know what that is. It's a shark tower. How do you know what that is?
How does nobody else not know what this is?
And even Ellen is like, he's just doing his job with zero heart put into it.
Yeah, because we have not a single lifeguard out there. So yeah. We got to have the sheriff up in the tower.
Brody sees something that's unclear, but he heads down and aims his gun with this little boy right in range and just fires away. It's then revealed that it's just a school of bluefish, guys. It's bluefish.
The downside to me is this is when we start to... This is the end of him, quote-unquote, losing his mind at this kind of thing. After this, it goes away. I think if it would have kept going deeper, I could have got on board, because I think there's something great about the entire town turning against him. But it doesn't really go that way. It's interesting, but I don't like the way that it's played. And I don't like what they have Lorraine Gary here doing, because I don't feel like they have her on really either side. And this contractor, construction, whatever the fuck he is, real estate agent with the mayor and the other people, it all feels so haphazard.
This, of course, makes Brody look crazy, and the council is fully right to do what they do to him. And this makes the character of Brody just unlikable, and I hate that this sequel does that.
it bugged me because, you know, you'd turn a hero to a zero like it's Hercules. But also, I gotta say, this isn't what happens to sheriffs. Sheriffs are elected. They're not voted on by city councils. But I mean, I get it. But then again, I want to see a man at the end of his rope. I want to see him turn into Quint. And I feel like that's what the script is telling us should happen. And then it doesn't happen.
We cut to Brody getting a call that the photos have been developed. And when he gets there, on top of the other photos of the orca, we're seeing another one being developed very slowly. And it's revealed to be the outline of a shark. He takes the photo to a council meeting, and of course, they don't see anything other than seaweed and dirt on the lens. Even if it is a shark, guys, what does this mean?
Dang it, I can't blame the council members, because It doesn't look like a shark.
Well, no, it does. If you look at, the eyes are there.
One half of one eye is there in the corner, yes.
And I love this monologue as he's like, I hope you do something about this shark because I don't intend on going through that hell again. I feel like this is Roy Scheider this entire shooting schedule. We then cut to Mike at a bar with friends, and he's upset that he's grounded and talking about how his dad freaked out on the beach. Andy is that one friend that I imagine that I am. This guy with the fluffy hair who's just like trying to calm him down. How about this, boys? Late 70s, these kids in a fucking bar.
So I mean, it's the 70s, so yeah. Drinking age would have been 18, and a lot of bars on a place like that would not have cared.
No, they're probably so influxed with people and short staffed that they just don't care. Like, they're not going to go through the time of carding people.
I mean, I remember being, I could leave base. I was well under 21, but as long as I was in uniform, I got served under 21 without a problem.
Everyone's all set to go, and Mike gets gaslit into going and not painting toilets on the beach. So this chick's like, do you always do what your parents tell you to do? We cut to Brody coming home and telling Ellen that, of course, they don't see the shark. And by the way, Adam, did you catch what he saw on his porch?
Oh, the barrel?
Yeah. Yeah, the player box that was the barrel. I thought that was a nice touch.
I thought that was kind of cool, which I think now can be bought as a sipper at Universal Studios.
And he's telling Ellen that, of course, they didn't see the shark, and he's off the force, singing Hail to the Chief to Hendrix. But here's the problem with this, guys. So he's fired. All of this is inconsequential, because by the next day, he's doing exactly what he was doing as a chief anyway.
Yeah, and there's no repercussions. Like, nobody goes out to, like, nobody makes a citizen's arrest. They don't send the police to go, like, get that boat. It's just some movie that tries to have like actual character ramifications without the real without thinking of like the real life structure of how this would be.
Exactly.
And they would have made him turn in his truck the moment he resigned.
Yeah, the moment, exactly.
It doesn't matter other than fake drama. It's one of those turn in your badge and your gun. All right, I'm going to go do it anyway. We don't even get that. I mean, it's to your point, it's John McClane.
We cut to Brody and Ellen in bed as Mike fiddles around and gets ready to go sailing. He's interrupted by Sean, who begs to go with him.
Why does this kid want to go sailing? Like, you're 10 years old.
Damn little kids.
This kid, Sean, this is the brother of Perry Kilpin, who was on Frasier, by the way. And he ended up dying a couple years ago. He was 56 years old. Mike decides to take him because he knows if he doesn't, Sean will tell on him. We cut to the docks, and Mike is there saying that he can go out if he wants to. Boy, I'll go to Adam on this one. Adam, pussy will get you in trouble every time, won't it?
Every fucking time. I mean, I'm not saying that I haven't done this exact same thing.
Same, but that's why I said it.
She is not cute enough to be worth that much trouble.
Exactly. What's up with that Bob haircut?
I don't mind the haircut, but I mean, come on, at least get us, you know what? It's PG rated. It's PG.
So this dork Timmy gets to go out with Brooke. We barely even see this guy. This fucking Napoleon Dynamite looking motherfucker. Like, again, just one of these many characters that we barely get to know.
They all blend together.
Yep,
they do. They all blend in.
And then this fucking, the son of the mayor, he's just an asshole. And he just seems so brokenhearted that he lost his broad to this dork. Oh my God, this dynamic here is just not here.
It doesn't matter by the end of this.
No.
Like, it's, again, fake drama.
We get more Williams montage music as they pass by an expedition boat going down for some lobster. And what a transition, as this is when we follow these guys for a bit. Like, we're going from, like, Andy knows these guys, so they're driving by, hey, how's it going? And then as they go by in the boat, we stay on this lobster dive.
This is an interminable 2 hours that I know is only 10 minutes by the counter on my freaking Netflix. But the second these kids start to get together to this entire dive, this is slow ass moving for a movie that is not 90 minutes. I cannot believe we got to spend so much time with this B-roll.
Yes, this is one of the biggest most egregious examples of stretching it out. Like, this movie has so much padding in it, it might as well be, I might as well be shopping at IKEA.
They go in the water looking for some lobster, and we get another little medley here as the swimmers are seemingly being successful, but it's interrupted by the shark, and we get another underwater attack. This wetsuit looks like Spider-Man, by the way. I caught that as he's going up to the surface. We see the divers yelling to go in, and this is when we get yet another transition, this time of the shark swimming by and heading right for the swimmers. But I don't know, nobody gets eaten here. One guy is like kind of scared, I guess. You know, he's kind of run into shock because of that. But Adam, as you mentioned, if there's no death or anything here, why are we even staying on these people?
And that's the amazing thing. When this finished, I'm like, well, wait, who got killed? Wait, nobody got eaten? Nobody's missing a limb? What was the point?
Yeah, it's this superfluous, like, diving community, which you'd think Brody, before he turned in his badge, would have forbidden this kind of shit.
All right, so I want to bring this up right now. Guys, we're seeing the shark more often in this one. Once again, Mechanical Shark, they brought back the same team who worked on the shark from last week. Do we find this any better than last week's shark?
Better? No. There's some parts where, fine, it works the same, but by trying to do more, it ends up being less effective. Now, I mentioned I like some of the fin shots, but every time you're trying to have a shark pop through a boat towards the screen expecting to scare me, it's ineffective.
I think it's worse.
So we get another montage of the sailors, this time with the Jaws theme playing in the background. We cut to Brody waking up and seeing that Mike and Sean are gone. He's not the least bit concerned. Parenting 101, if your kids aren't there in the morning, there's something wrong, right, Adam?
Well, we feel that way. God knows our parents were just like,
yeah.
You know, I'd come home 3 days later. I was at Garrett's the last couple days. Okay.
We cut to Tina and Eddie. They're out on their boat. They're away from the group, and I guess they just want to come out here and fuck. And she's saying that she has marks on her butt, so he's got to go. He's got to get the blanket. Boat's called Tina's Joy, which I found funny. We see that huge shark fin as the shark hits the boat and Eddie falls in and the boat gets taken further away. Now, this kid apparently did not know how to swim. And boy, can you tell. Once he falls in, I think he's flipping out a little bit.
Were their names really Tina and Eddie?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. It makes me think of the Billy Joel song, Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. I know nobody's name of these teens because I don't give a shit.
The only reason I know is because I had to do the plot summary and I looked on IMDb to find them. Eddie tries swimming for safety, but he gets pulled under in a pool of red, and Tina is just terrified, and William's music helps out too. I think this scene's pretty good. I like this attack. It might be a big highlight of the film for me.
I think she sells the fear well. I like her being catatonic, you know, a little bit later. I could have used a little more of this. Yeah. I mean, we wait a long time to get here. The blood is not as ridiculous as we got with some of the kills last week. So, yeah, I mean, this one does a decent job, but it's too little too late for me to, you know, be invested, but I really could have used more of this. But I don't care about these two. I don't even know which two these ones are. And that's the biggest problem, is I don't care that he died.
I love the touch of him pulling himself up and pulling the wood off as he falls.
I love the way he just pulls back under and he's gone.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a long struggle. Like, he comes back up, and once he's pulled back under, there's not pieces, there's not a jacket that flies back. He's just, it's still.
Yeah, I'm always
the shark's a swallower.
I'm always thinking of the scene as I swim in deep water. It's just always implanted in my mind. She's even like asking for her mommy and make it go away. Your mind just does weird things in situations like this. And I think she sells that okay, as Adam mentioned. Maybe the most terrifying part of the movie is this scene right here. So Brody pulls in, even though it's not his job anymore. And they see a diver who has an embolism. And this is when Ellen and Brody are told that Mike is out there. Boy, they got to be told by these people that Mike's out in the water. And of course, Hendricks doesn't say anything. He's just like, okay, you just do what you want, whatever. Brody takes the boat out despite the protest from Hendricks, and they head towards the lighthouse. And of course, Ellen's on the boat as well. We see Brody, who's not the chief anymore, but he has the power to call for a chopper. Why does anyone say, dude, you can't request a chopper? You can't request anything. You're not chief anymore.
Yeah, to get to the chopper.
We cut to these boats roaming around. This must have been tough to coordinate. You know, as somebody who's been on set, I couldn't imagine being out in the ocean and having to film these boats travel. So I got a little respect for Short for that.
Yeah, tell that to Kevin Costner.
Right. We cut to Tina's boat. Brody pulls up next to it. They eventually find Tina, who's in complete shock. And in her dismay, just yells, shark! Therefore, proving Brody right the entire time. Adam, you think she sells this okay?
I do. She might give the best performance in this film.
You're not wrong. Swark even does some overhead shots to establish where they are, and Tina just looks terrified, just doing the shakes. Brody calls the Coast Guard to take them in, and he gets the direction where they're headed and takes the boat out himself. This is not how boating works. You don't just point and say, that's where they're going.
This part got to me, because this entire thing should have been leading up to him being willing to take a boat out by himself. He was scared to death of it in the first film, and then he had to do it with two other men. The first time he takes it out, he's got his wife with him. Now he's got to go out on his own to rescue these kids. This should have been a dramatic, just really poignant moment. And it's there, but it is not in this screenplay. And Schneider, I think he's actually given something here, but this should have been what this shit was about, was a man just really getting back to his white whale by being able to go out and do this on his own.
And also the movie, it's inconsistent. Is he afraid of the water still or not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you guys catch the subtle nods to Quint and Hooper too in his wardrobe? He's wearing a gray t-shirt and he's wearing a green jacket over it. So the green jacket is Quint's and the gray t-shirt is Hooper's. So nice little subtle nod there. We get this weird monologue from Keith Gordon about damning the torpedoes as the shark makes its appearance known, and Gordon pulls himself to safety as all the boats are rocked and Mike knocks himself out. So the shark
all they needed was a porpoise to hurl itself into the path of the shark.
I don't know, this shark just pushes this boat into all the other boats, and this one attack just throws everything off kilter.
I don't understand why they're out in the middle of nowhere. Supposedly in the middle of nowhere. Because at one shot, there's a bridge in the background. And I don't know how on this island there's a fucking bridge to somewhere, but that's not how islands work, you know? But how far away are they that this is just such a... I hate everything about this flotilla that they have out here at sea.
Well, they're headed to this island located out in the middle here. And apparently this set was tough to shoot on because everybody was slipping on it. And at one point, it even floated out in the water. And Schwark had got a call in the middle of the night saying, your set's like floating out towards Bermuda. You got to go get it. I get where they're going, but I don't get why they're going, if that makes sense. In the course of all this, Sean falls in and the boats crash into one another. Sean's pulled up, but Mike is still out there. They see him, and they get out next to him as a shark approaches. He almost gets... Yeah.
And also, this movie has the problem of the shark is fast when the script wants it to be, and then other parts, it is so slow that you wonder how it is able to eat anybody.
And they had the saddle on the shark so they can get this shot from behind the shark fin as it approaches Mike, which, you know, it's innovative. I'll give Schwark that. I mean, he's trying to do what he can here, but he's no fucking Spielberg.
You know, I like changing up some of the shots with the shark. Yeah. You got to do something different, and I appreciate it. It's one, because it's been mimicked so much since, you know, you got to remember this is the first time you really had that kind of shot, and sometimes it works. The problem is the scare isn't there. They're trying to make an action movie more than a horror movie, and the action doesn't do what it's got to do.
So the shark almost gets there, and we even see the fake mouth and hear him roar as he misses Mike. They see the shark circling until it finally goes under. We cut to Brody, who's driving toward the lighthouse and calling the helicopter, asking if he has the kids in sight yet. The pilot says no and says that he'll meet Brody at Francis Shoal. And he then says out loud, I'm all alone out here. Yes, you are, sir. We go back to the boats and no one wants to play charades, but they think that they're saved as the helicopter approaches. Okay, so this helicopter scene, man, this is the
sheriff showing up in misery.
This was a scene. As a kid, again, I was terrified of this shark coming to the helicopter window. But when I think of it now, how ridiculous is it that this shark took out this entire fucking helicopter?
Yeah, and apparently it ate the helicopter, too.
Yeah! And of course, we have the blades just falling, and they're all separating, and all the sails, but of course, none of them hit the kids, because this is a PG movie.
Quite the scene, but you just addressed something that I have in my note. Okay, why are they stopping from sailing where they need to go? Why did they stop to be attacked? They're in sailboats. They didn't run out of gas. Yeah. They didn't break a rudder. But for some reason, they stopped for this entire scene to happen. When this helicopter shows up, my note is, holy fuck, they got a helicopter. And I'm like, don't tell me the shark's going to eat a helicopter. God damn it, the shark ate a helicopter. Where's the shark bat repellent when you need the bat shark repellent when you need it? Batman wouldn't put up with this shit.
Well, I think, to answer your question about why they're stopped, I think it's because of the previous scene where they're attacked and the boats all kind of crashed into one another. I think.
Yeah, but there's three boats. Leave one, get in the two boats, and you can sail. Like, yeah. The sails are still there until a fucking helicopter blade slashed through.
I find this comical for all the wrong reasons. A, I'm thinking of Adam West, which I guess, you know, I'd rather be watching that because I would much rather have a preference. But the fact that the guy tries to pull up and it takes him forever to adjust the throttle. Like, everybody operates at different speeds in this movie.
I don't know, guys. I think I'm having a better time with this than you guys. I'm not invested in the story. And last week, I was so invested. But I think the shark scenes work pretty well for me for the most part. I'm enjoying the shark stuff. But again, like I mentioned, the best stuff last week wasn't the shark. So
I could understand people coming back to this film 40 years later and finding fun in it. This is my first watch after seeing a 9 out of 10 last week.
Yeah.
So this is the sequel that I'm being given.
Boy, wait till the next couple weeks. That's all I'll say. So the shark attacks the boat some more as people are knocked off, including Sean, who's saved by Marge, who then gets eaten. And my God, is Jackie's scream ear piercing. But again, this Marge character, we hardly see her. I think she's the one who pulls Sean with her when he's with Mike. She's like, hey, you can come with me. So that's why these two get separated. But we don't know this character that well. And when we see her get eaten, when we see the shark from behind, by the way, I feel nothing.
No, and I don't understand the relationships, so I don't know who's going to be sad or care or what. None of these kids matter to me. Even them being Brody's kids don't matter to me at this point.
Yeah, James Hetfield should have been the pilot, because nothing else matters from here on out.
Oh my God, you're pulling the reference out today, sir. Ellen tells Len that she doesn't give a shit what he's thinking. All she knows is that her son and husband are still out in that water. But she doesn't know where her younger son is. So.
Yeah, they also forget how many kids they have.
Yes!
It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a shark attacked. You know where your children are.
Meanwhile, Brody can't get in contact with the helicopter, and we see that a storm is approaching. We then cut to Andy threatening Sean to grab the rope, otherwise he's going to break his ass. Sean's in complete trauma mode, but he grabs the rope and ties it onto the boat as he's pulled to the others, and Larry falls in. Then Andy hugs Sean, saying he thought they'd lost him, and boy, this was awkward. He's kind of embracing and kissing that kid a little too much here.
Yeah, boy, those kids moved on from Marge being eaten in front of their eyes very quick.
Right. Jackie is cold, and Larry is still on a tear as Renee begs God to help them. And my God, Larry even does like the airplane thing of grabbing this chick and shaking her.
Yeah, I mean, if he should have slapped her and gone all the way, like the freaking, that scene in Airplane.
Yeah. We cut to Brody, who pulls up next to Mike's boat, and Mike has to tell him that, yeah, Sean's out there too, in case you didn't know. And he just delivers this line like, that's okay, isn't it? No, it's not okay. Brody tells him to get to the lighthouse and heads out yet again. We see the gang almost to the island, and Doug says that the changing wind won't let them get there. They keep trying to paddle, as Andy says not to due to the shark, and then they get stuck. Which begs the question, if they're stuck here, the shark would have a harder time here.
Harder time, the shark would not be able to be that shallow. But we said that last week, where that motherfucker might as well have had feet as close as it got to the beach. Like, I know you don't want to jump out and swim because it's dangerous, but guess what a couple of them do anyway in about 30 seconds. But if you're this close, bullshit, I'm not paddling. It's right there. It is as close as a walk to the mailbox.
They get stuck, but of course Jackie thinks it's that thing, as she says. And this is all interrupted when Sean recognizes that his dad is headed towards them. They cheer again and wave Brody in. Sometimes it's sunny and sometimes it's dusk here. So you can tell they filmed this in way different times. Brody sees that they're stuck, and this is when the shark attacks again. Brody pulls into the lighthouse and grabs a rescue raft. And as Matt mentioned, there's no PTSD from last week, and we're not seeing that Brody is struggling being out in the water. He just grabs this raft and jumps in, no problem.
I'll say, I understand why he's so scared of the water, because he is shit at driving a boat. Like, I've done it. It's not as easy as a car, but damn, he's bad at this.
He throws the rope over and tells him to tie it on, as we're getting some underwater shots as well to establish that the shark's still out there somewhere. Brody drops the anchor and tells him to pull it over, but it gets stuck, and when Brody tells him that he'll let off some slack, the shark attacks yet again. I don't know, man. I like the shark. I like this shot of the shark tearing its way through the fabric from underneath and then swimming away. I think that's good stuff. I don't know. I'm with this.
Look, stuff's happening, so I'm more into it here than I have been probably through the rest of the film. I don't care about who it's happening to other than Brody, but I don't hate this. I kind of like that we're getting some action out of the shark and stuff, but I'm flabbergasted that you could probably, I don't know, jump, take two strokes, and be on the rocks of that place. But I'd like what they got going on with the shark here.
Matt, are you at least liking what we're seeing here?
Yes, because now I feel like the shark is actually feeling like a viable predator. Not an object that you have to flip the switch so it moves fast enough.
But in the midst of all this, we're getting more Jackie screaming. We see Lucy almost get bitten, but the shark just swims past her. And, you know, as somebody who studied sharks for a while, that skin can cut anything. So I can see how it could just kind of swim by and cut her like this. But in a shark movie, you want to see shark attacks.
It would have been a good time to lose a limb.
Yeah. She's lucky she's just grazed. Brody drops the raft, and we see Chekhov's power line literally drop in front of him.
I guess God answered her messages, because the thing fucking rises up like Moses parting the Red Sea.
He sees Sean in trouble and screams his name, and then gets on the raft. Okay, so I got to say, guys, I should hate this. I should hate how it's even more ridiculous than last week's finale. I should hate how the shark literally swims up, and instead of going for Brody in the raft, it rises up and bites the power line. I really should hate this, but I don't know if it's the way Scheider's just playing up the confidence and egging the shark on, or if it's Williams' musical themes finally coming in tune with me and hitting me in the exact right spot, or how the shark looks when it's burning up, but I love this. Call me crazy. I love how he disposes of this shark.
Well, I like this because it reminds me of the Universal ride.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is how taking
my nostalgic goggles off. This makes me appreciate watching a shark get blown up by a magic bullet.
I'm enjoying this cheesiness of this. It might as well have like tightened up its laces before it decides to run at Brody here, you know? I mean, he's egging him on, and yeah, I'm glad that Great White speak English so it knows. And it's, you know, it's the cheesiness that this needs. I wish more of it was this. You know, just a little bit of camp throughout would have helped this film. But I'm not upset at this. I know exactly what's coming. You know, there is no doubt whatsoever. We've known that this shark is going to bite through this power cord since we saw it at the beginning of this film. So, yeah, give me it.
Well, if you want camp, you can watch Grizzly, which is Jaws in a park.
I was thinking the exact same thing.
We can't close this park. We make too much money.
After the shark goes down, Brody goes to Sean, who says he was forced to go. Brody laughs, says sure they did, and they paddle off as credits roll on Jaws 2, boys.
Thing ends in a hurry. Was the
shark it does.
That cable? They don't even get back to Amity.
All right. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Jaws 2? Adam, as a first-time viewer of this, what about you, sir?
For some reason, I have heard a lot the last couple weeks, couple months, and it's probably because Jaws is re-released and it's 50th anniversary, of a lot of people saying, you know, what we really should be doing is revisiting Jaws 2, because that movie deserves a second look by a lot of people. And I'm here to tell you, no, it doesn't. No, it really doesn't. All the magic that was brought forth for Jaws, and especially the way that you overcome troublesome productions and really make movie something that makes the movies great, you know, something that makes Nicole Kidman talk about him at the beginning at the AMC. Check that off for this week. that existed last week, and none of that is here. This, you want to know where sequelitis started in Hollywood? It's with this. It really is. And Carl Laemmle would be rolling over if he knew Universal put out this kind of shit in the wake of such an amazing movie that really transformed the silver screen. I understand this made a lot of money. I understand this was the highest grossing movie for a while. I understand that this got people back into movie theaters and reignited blockbusters and summer movies. But this movie is crap. It is a bad script. It is horribly acted. It is badly paced. It is badly shot. John Williams is here somewhere. He might as well be composing under the water for the way that this score sounds. This is as insulting of a sequel to an amazing movie as I think we've discussed yet. I understand people that love Jaws are going to have some affinity for this in a cheesy way, but this is the first time I've seen this movie, and I'm offended this movie exists, because I think it does that much damage to the magic of Jaws. Maybe if I revisit this in 20 years, I'll enjoy the cheesiness of it. But today, I'm astonished of how bad this is. This is a 3, because I can't bring myself to give it a patented 4 on 10. I think of when we discuss another movie and its abysmal sequel, I went from a high score to a 4, and this is worse than that. So 3 on 10 for Jaws 2.
Oh, Matt, if he feels this way now, how is he going to feel in a couple weeks? All right. Goudreau, go ahead, sir.
I hate those articles Adam is alluding to, because I'm pretty sure I saw at least three of them by the time the Jaws re-release was making its way into theaters. I hate this bullshit revisionist history of, oh, now we're going to prop up bad movies just because enough time has passed. I'm not as harsh as Adam, but I'm pretty damn close. We took the wrong lessons from Jaws 2, and this is kind of the blueprint for, like, how not to do a sequel, where it was financially driven. You got creative people back only for monetary gain. You got people back just sleepwalking or sleep composing in the case of John Williams. And they didn't even make a good slasher movie. It's a dull one. Like, this reminds me of like the lesser, like this is very much Friday the 13th part 3 without the stupid gimmick. Although I would have gotten some enjoyment out of watching the shark put on a hockey mask to cover up that scarred face. It's a 4 on 10 because I found a lot of it to not even be like fun enjoyment in watching a bad movie, because the pacing in this is, I mean, they should have called this movie Slugs because it's so slow. There is an actual horror movie called Slugs. I'm not endorsing it, but I'd rather watch it than this. So it's a 4 on 10. I understand the compromised vision, and this thing went through two directors. You had a main star who did not want to be there, and it's evident as saying Roy Scheider didn't want to be there is like saying the shark is named Bruce. We all knew that, and you can stop repeating it because it's so obvious. So it's a 4 on 10 for me. And look, calling this the best Jaws sequel, quote unquote, I don't know if that's true. We got two more movies to go, but this is not a high bar to cross over.
All right. Well, I guess I'll be this guy then. I don't have nearly as much hate for this as you guys do. I do see some good things here. I like the shark scenes here. I still have residual love for Brody and these characters from last week. But we don't have the director from last week. We don't have the players that Brody had to play off of last week. And it really hurts this film. We're trying to get this bullshit human enemy in Len Peterson here. He confronts Brody, but it wasn't the same as the mayor character from last week. And even Murray Hamilton's not the same, as I mentioned the reason why earlier in this podcast. However, as a fan of those slasher films, as a fan of horror films, I got some real joy out of seeing this scarred shark going after these people. Now, the problem with this is you have so many kids here, and we have no real deaths to speak of. We have a couple big set pieces. We have a huge helicopter scene. But I felt for Alex Kittner last week, even the small amount of time we spent with him before he was killed. I don't feel any of that here. And I think by bringing these characters back, by bringing even the screenwriters, Howard Sackler, he's the one who came up with the Indianapolis speech last week. We have Carl Gottlieb here, who did a lot of that writing on set last week. Even with all that, we're kind of just treading water, to use a pun that Matt hates so much. I'm just not loving this as much, but I still like the shark scenes, and that makes it a 6 for me. I have that much residual like for this movie, and maybe it's just because of the fact I grew up with it. I watched this a lot as a kid, and I find some joy in rewatching it today. And boy, I have more joy watching this than, well, maybe not. Maybe we'll have more joy watching next week's film and the week after. Next week, we talk Jaws 3, or Jaws 3D, as it was in theaters the same year as Friday the 13th Part 3 that Matt mentioned earlier. Matt, sir, before I get to Adam, I got to ask you, what are you expecting when we talk Jaws 3 next week?
Or Jaws 3, Human Zero, which was their original concept, which we'll talk about, because this could have been a very different movie. I hope it's more fun than this. That's all I'll say.
Adam, this is a first-time viewing for you. What are you expecting when we talk Jaws 3, sir?
I think I'm going to talk about going to shark exhibits at theme parks. I think I'm going to understand some cheesiness with this one. Because my thought is this is more in the line of, God, I can't believe we're going to reference this movie for like the fourth time, but like a Die Hard 3. It's going to change and it's going to know it's tongue-in-cheek. And I'm hoping that helps me out, that when the movie knows that it's campy, I can go along with it. So I'm hopeful, but not very.
I'll mention this as a preview. Next week's film is the one I watched the most when I was growing up. Much like Superman 3, Jaws 3 was the first of this series that I watched, and it was the one I watched the most. So that's a little bit of a preview as to what I'll feel next week.
But this is the one that Michael Caine credits for buying a house, no, right?
No, that's the week after.
Ah, shit.
This next one is Dennis Quaid on coke every single time he's on screen. But we'll talk about that when we talk Jaws 3 next week. Boys, I'm sorry this wasn't as fun of an experience as it was for me, but maybe we'll reside that next week. Until next week, when we get to Jaws 3. Podcast! Thank you, boys.
But I'm telling you, and I'm telling everybody at this table, that that's a shark. And I know what a shark looks like because I've seen one up close. And you better do something about this one because I don't intend to go through that hell again.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
He did it! He did it! You see it? He did it!
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You know, you want to let that breathe for... Nothing.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
I have to take this abuse much longer.
It truly helps others find and discover this podcast.
Slow ahead. I can go slow ahead. Come on down and chump some of this shit.
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars,
the ongoing Marvel series,
Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones,
the Exorcist films,
Avatar, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
Stop playing with yourself, Hooper!
A Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Hey, watch how you're cutting that thing. It's critical.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Excuse me, Chief.
That's great. That's just great. Now where the hell are we, huh?
Scheduling done by Matt.
Then let me go with him.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Daddy, Daddy, look at the fish!
Holy shit!
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
How the hell you do that, man?
It wasn't easy, believe me.
You better watch yourself with that fancy electrical equipment down there, buddy.
Such a live wire liable to make your hair stick up funny.
That's good, Michael.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
A what?
Come and get me, you son of a bitch.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2025, and any and all sound and audio clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
Now why don't you take a long, close look at this sign? Those proportions are correct.
Love to prove that, wouldn't you? Get your name into the National Geographic.
We'll be right back.
Is this on?
Uh-huh.
We did go see Little Shop of Horrors in theaters because they re-released that. And that was an absolute blast. And in fact, I had seen the original ending, which I had never seen before. I only saw the happy ending, so I was glad to see the original. But I like events when they do it and they make sense. And Jaws 50 in theaters, mwah. I mean, chef's kiss. You couldn't have done it any better.
I thought you were talking about the Roger Corman Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, with Nicholson.
Oh, no, Rick Moranis and
Steve Martin. Oh, my God.
Steve Martin. Bill Murray, who I forgot was in that movie. John Candy, who I forgot was in that movie.
I haven't seen that movie since it was rented, when it first came out on video.
Maybe yeah, we'll it wasn't a sing-along, but with me in that theater, it might as well have been.
All right, well, that was... We're seeing an underwater expedition as they go investigate the orca. I like this as it has some continuity and it kind of puts a bookmark on the last film. Divers go in. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, because I'm going to complain when the shark shows up.
Okay. So the divers